Hey,
what is up, everybody?
well, Mr. AJ.
Did we start some cheese today?
I thought I was going to have a nice, pleasant Sunday, and
I leave it to me.
Then you do that show, and not that there was anything wrong with that show. I would have preferred Name Stay out of it, but.
I tried, but that didn't happen. Yeah, we kind of went down the rabbit hole a little. You saw the moment our face changed the minute the network got named, and we all just went, oh, shit. Yeah. Like, the show's over.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, no, but you want to know what, though? Like I said, like, I tried to say during the show today, I tried to say, listen, I'm a person that wants to listen to all sides. I don't care about one side only, even though I'm friends with them. You know, obviously, they have mounds and mounds of paperwork. One of the reasons why we had a guest host on today, he used to be a private investigator. He's one of our viewers. He's probably watching right now.
Is that Chris Binder?
Chris Binder. Oh, okay. That was Chris. Okay. Chris.
I was wondering.
Used to be a private investigator, and I brought him on the show, and I wanted to just throw him in the mix and see what happened, see what his thought of all the evidence that this guy has printed out with his daughter, who's 17 years old, on all of these people, like messages and everything. He had a folder this big on the show. I mean, you and as Chris said, he's like, obviously, I don't know their side of the story. He goes, but from doing work as a private investigator, he goes, I don't even make files that big on people.
Yeah,
he goes, for you to come up with that many files, he goes, that's got to show something. He's like, not saying that he's like on the side of the apes, but you know, it shows something, you know? And like I told everyone, I don't mind anyone coming on the show and saying, debating back about what he said, but don't say any hearsay seashed stuff. Actually come on with evidence like he did, like actual paper of like conversations and stuff like that. That would be great to see. But unfortunately, you know how the hounds get in our paranormal world, and they like to, the minions come out and they start attacking everything that you love. So we're going through that phase right now.
Yeah, I would. I think it's important to say, and we should say this now, that Parapost Network Central had no idea that was going to happen.
Parapost had absolutely no idea that that show was going to happen the way that it happened, nor did I even know that show was going to go the way that it happened. So that is an apology on my end, being a Parapost admin that should have stopped that in the middle of it. But unfortunately I did not, and I should have, but I wanted to bring up a big point of what's going on. The biggest point of what happened there was, it goes to show that you can have the most viewers in the world. If you talk about the most disgusting stuff around, which is hurting other people. Today, we saw such an increase in viewership over this drama. It was disgusting. It's great to see because it's a great thing to have your show get lifted like that, but it's for the wrong reason. And that's what the whole point of this was to show people humans' behavior is kind of disgusting sometimes. We're so sick in wanting to know or understanding someone else's drama. It's kind of crazy.
And although I will say this, you know I'm a huge advocate on locations.
Yeah.
And saving locations and preserving locations and all those wonderful things. And Enfield Demon House is no different.
No.
I will always do my best to protect locations, and whether it's, you know, not always necessarily this stuff, but, you know, I will stand up for them if I know that all the stuff is not right, or what is being said is not the whole truth. My advocacy is more on the end of making sure that they don't disappear.
That's what it is.
And you know, and that's what I fight for locations. Yeah. And you know, we've had several locations in the States disappear. We've had locations in Canada disappear. And I'm sure there's been many, many locations in Europe or across the world that have disappeared for, you know, the wrong reasons. And that's why Global Ghost Hunt is Global Ghost Hunt. And that's what we're trying to do. Yes, it's about the teams, but it is more about the locations. And whether she's right, he's right, whatever. At the end of the day, it's about a location that he preserved and kept going. They're trying to run a business. I'm sure they don't want all this stuff. I'm sure the others don't want all this stuff. But at the end of the day, we have to look at the real picture, the bigger picture. It's about the location and the reputation of the location. And if somebody is out, and I'm not saying there is, if somebody is out trying to destroy that, that's where I have a problem. And you know, it's too bad. And we always see it. We always say it. We always hear it. You know, we're all in this together. Yes, some people are not going to get along with other people. I'm surely not going to get along with everyone. AJ, you don't get along with everyone.
No.
But we're all in trying to do the same thing. Unfortunately, there's a few people that are not. And that's with any business. Like in the acting world, you have people that are actors and actresses that are very shady, you know, and
jealousy,
Well, it's jealousy. They'll do anything to stab you in the back. And if they want a part that you're up for and they didn't get it because you did, yeah, stuff happens, stuff is said, unfortunately. Yeah. And obviously that is jealousy.
Yeah.
Through and through, that's definitely jealousy. And
it's sad. It really
is. I wish we could figure out a way to get for us to get along, all of us.
Yeah.
But reality, that's just not going to happen, unfortunately.
But you know what the worst part about stuff like this is that the hardest part is us as hosts, you know, we bring on guests, and when the guest wants to talk about something and they go off on something or they start talking about something, you know, it's kind of rude to be like, oh, no, stop. We're not. Sorry. You can't talk about that. You know what I mean? It's very hard to say that to them because they're passionate about being attacked. And what people don't know about that place is that place was actually started by their 17-year-old daughter, who's 17 now. She was, I think, like 3 or 4 years younger when she started it and helped the family start the paranormal business or whatever in 2020. I believe that's what they said. Somewhere around there was when they started the actual business. And I tell you what, she was so hurt by all of this because this is something she really loves and something she truly believes in, because what she experienced in this house being a young girl and everything. And for her to work so hard on a business and then have, say, a couple grown-ups who have, you know, these personal vendettas with people or want to cause all these little issues, don't realize they're attacking a little girl. They're not attacking the parents are getting involved because you're attacking a little girl, you know, and people aren't seeing that part of it. And that's why we wanted to get it out there. But at the same time, I think that it kind of got out of hand, and, you know, it's unfortunate, but we want to hear all sides, whether we disagree or agree. It's about free speech, you know?
Yeah. And it doesn't go without saying that, you know, the person that was talked about a lot and myself, we do not speak anymore. And, and a lot of people know that, and that's fine, but I am not, and you know, your guests are entitled to whatever they want to say, but I'm not going to come on to a show as a host and bash someone. I'm just not going to do it, as much as I don't like him. And I have very, very good reasons why not to like him.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, and he knows why. A lot of people know why. But at the end of the day, it's about the locations. So
you're right. And that's the main thing I was trying to get across today, you know, is it's about the location. Like, I know for where I live, this location is in my state where I live. And, you know, I don't know of a lot of places in our state, you know. And when I found this place, this is a very highly active place. And, you know, obviously you're going to go to any location. You're going to sometimes get paranormal activity. You're sometimes going to not. It's just that given. But to, you know, to hear that this location is getting attacked to the point where they almost had nobody signing up for the summertime. Their business was literally dropping completely face off the earth because of this. And it was like all because of this drama. You know, this girl is going to lose her business that she created for her family. For what? You know what I mean? And that we're going to lose a location as investigators. It's just, it's all not right, but not that this could make it right, but hopefully the awareness somewhere down the road can help, you know?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. But speaking of locations, I think we should announce we had another sign up over the weekend for the Global Ghost Hunt. And that is Phantom Detectives. LLC with Joshua and the lead investigator. I've been speaking to him a little bit through email. His name is Rick Warner. I'm not sure if he's the lead investigator or Joshua is, but he is an investigator with the team. And their thumbnail came out on Global Ghost Hunt Facebook page today. And
just today,
Did you receive it?
Nathan just texted me literally right before I came on the show. And I go, don't worry, sending it over. He's like, all right, got you.
Yeah. So, that's fantastic. We have another team signing up or with us, and they're doing a great location as well. And what is the location called again? Sorry. I want to get the name.
Oh, it's called, go ahead. I'll let you look it up.
It's called, let me just double check. Sorry, Joshua and Rick. It is called the Painted Stave Distilling.
Distilling, that was the word I was looking for. I said Sully.
Distilling or distilling? Yeah, distilling. Distilling. That looks like a great location. So their thumbnail did come out today. It's on Global Ghost Hunt Facebook page. If you can, go over there and share it out to a couple of groups if you can. That would be amazing. It will be going up everywhere else. And you know, it's funny. I posted one of our videos that you sent the other day up on TikTok. It got almost 2,000 views.
No way.
Yeah.
That was that one video, right, that we did the intro for? Okay, I saw that
one. It's almost 2,000 views, that video.
Wow.
So that's cool. That's very awesome. Cool. Very cool. So our name is getting out there when it comes to the crime documentaries and the videos that we show. And this one is no exception.
Please dive us into it because I know Aileen.
Oh my God. This woman. Oh my God. Like, first of all, let's be honest. She's not the most attractive person in the world.
Oh my God, bro. Oh my God, no.
Yeah. Aileen, or is it Eileen or Aileen?
Yeah, I would say I think it's Aileen.
Yeah,
but still.
She was what looks like to be a lovely prostitute that apparently didn't like her Johns.
Yeah.
Because she killed six of them.
Mm-hmm.
And
what she said before she died was the best part.
She say before she died?
I think she said something along, I don't want to mess with the documentary because I'm not the exact sure of the words, but she basically cursed everyone basically. It basically said a big F you at the end. Yeah, it was funny as hell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Finally, okay, Chris.
Only Chris. Only Chris.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you know this or not, and I didn't look at it, and I was going to, and I forgot. Has there been a woman that's been executed? I know she was executed in 2002.
Yeah.
Okay. But when was the last woman that was executed in your country?
Let me see. Executed.
Because she was executed October 9th, 2002. I was just wondering who was the last woman that was executed? Because there can't be that many.
Yeah, I'm trying to find that out right now. Lisa Montgomery was executed by the U.S. federal government on January 13th, 2021.
So okay, there's one in 2003 too.
Yeah, and then 2021, I guess, was the last one.
But I will say it was a the movie Monster was a fantastic movie. Charlize Theron, who played, Eileen.
Yeah.
Or Aileen. Oh,
Chris just said Amber McLaughlin was 2023. I didn't know that, Chris. I just searched it. I didn't know that.
Okay. So there has been a few.
Yeah.
But
it's been, I think, over 18, I think, since 1976.
And obviously everybody knows that Charlize won the Oscar for her portrayal of this wonderful person.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this documentary, I was kind of like, obviously I watched a little bit of it. I didn't watch all of it. I just watched a bit of it because I didn't want to watch. Like, obviously all of us really know this story because it's fairly new. And, yeah. But hopefully there's going to be things in this documentary that we didn't know. This woman is crazy. Why though? Why was she crazy?
Exactly. Too bad we couldn't have her on the show to ask.
Yeah, that would be amazing. That would be awesome. But can you imagine having a serial killer?
Dude, it would be the best interview in the entire world. I'm sorry to say this. I mean, I would not want to be doing an interview next to that person, but I bet you would be one of the best interviews to get into the mind of these craziest people in the world, you know?
Yeah.
I love psychology.
And she, and Chris is saying that she transitioned from male to female while in prison.
Oh.
Is that Amber woman you're talking about?
It has
because wouldn't it be female to male while in prison?
Yeah, if it was Aileen.
It was Amber. Okay. So I will let people know, and I let AJ know during the week, that I am in talks right now on bringing up a judge to the show. Now, I will let people know he is a civil judge, but before he became a judge, he was a defense attorney, and he was a very, very well-known defense attorney here in Canada. So he's going to be the right guy to speak to when it comes to these type of, what do you want to call them? These type of
crazies. People.
These type of people. Yeah. I was trying to be nice. These type of people. But yeah, hopefully we'll get him up. I'm hoping next week. And you know what's really funny, how I know this guy is he's an actor as well. And he's with my the same agency I'm with. That's how I know
him. Oh, that's great.
So he's agreed that he's going to come up, and but we just got to narrow down a date. So I'm hoping next week. If not next week, it'll probably be the following week. But Carmine is he's a fantastic, fantastic guy. I saw him in December at the Christmas party that the agency held for all the actors on the roster. But what's really great is, and I told AJ this during the week as well, he lives in a haunted house. So I've been bugging Carmine to let me come in his house and do an investigation because he's got security cameras in his house, and he actually captured a woman on the security camera. Now,
no
women live in the house.
Oh my God.
So you actually hear a woman's voice on the security camera saying something. It's hard to really, I still have it trying to work it out. It's really, really been difficult, but she is saying something, but it's cool. It's super, super cool. So I'm hoping maybe I'll convince him while he's on the show. We'll get everybody in the audience to convince him. And then what I'll do is I'll go live for the investigation.
That would be awesome. That would be awesome.
It'd be really, really cool. So I'm going to pressure him. I saw him in December and I said, let me investigate your house. Cause he was standing in front of me.
Yeah.
And I go, dude, let me go in there. And he kept on laughing. So
yeah, he's like, hell no, I don't want none of that demon crap.
Yeah. So anyhow, Carmine will be coming up soon. It'll be great to have a judge. Now I'd rather have nothing wrong with Canadian judges. Love them. Yeah. But I think there's more that goes down in the States than in Canada when it comes to these type of people. So it'd be nice to have a judge who's been on one of these cases. You know what I mean? That would be really, really cool. So anyhow, let's get to the documentary. Or do you have anything to say?
I am ready. I am ready.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Everybody else ready in the room? Okay, here we go.
November the 30th, 1989, Central Florida. When a 51-year-old male picked up a prostitute from the side of the road, he had no idea that she would turn out to be a cold-blooded killer.
She was just utterly remorseless. This was somebody who enjoyed watching men die.
She shot him 4 times with a 9-shot revolver.
In her mass murder spree, hardened killer Eileen Wuornos targeted middle-aged wealthy men with expensive cars.
She killed Theo. There was no sympathy, no... She was just a ruthless, mean bitch.
Very few women have ever killed in such a violent, vile manner in history.
Eventually, she was recorded confessing with the help of her girlfriend.
What? I'm not going to go to jail. If I have to confess, I will. Why the hell did you do this? Why did you do this?
In just 1 year, this female serial killer callously shot, robbed, and murdered 7 men, making Eileen Wuornos one of the world's most evil killers. Daytona Beach, Florida. It was here that sex worker Eileen Wuornos went on a murderous rampage between November 1989 and November 1990. Her actions left locals fearing for their lives.
Wuornos shot and killed at point-blank range 7 men between 1989 and 1990.
Here is somebody who is deliberately targeting men who are looking to engage in the services of a sex worker, and she is killing them and robbing them and disposing of their bodies.
Detective David Taylor was on the police task force that was instrumental in bringing Wuornos to justice.
It shocked the community that once we identified Eileen Wuornos as the killer of these men, that a female was that vicious in killing these people.
About 9 in 10 serial killers are men and 1 in 10 are women. Female serial killers tend to use quite remote methods like poisoning, but Wuornos literally went and picked victims as they drove past her on the highway. It's very rare to have a female serial killer, but it's even rarer to have one that kills in the way that Wuornos did. She essentially killed like a man.
Mike Joyner was an undercover police officer on the Wuornos case and was key to her arrest.
She would be on the side of the road and prostituting. She would pick up men as they stopped to help her. And then she would take them somewhere and kill them and take their money or take whatever value they had.
Detective Brian Jarvis was also on the Wuornos task force, and he recalls the impact her killing spree had on Florida.
At this particular time, because of the way the bodies were found, the way things turned up, there was a lot of panic all over this.
To have a serial killer on the loose is something that is going to have an impact on any community. Everybody in Florida uses the highways. Everybody feels that they have that connection to this case.
This killer's story begins in 1956. Eileen Wuornos was born on the 29th of February in Rochester, Michigan. Her mother was just 16 years old when she gave birth and was unable to raise her.
By March 1960, when Eileen's just 4, she's formally adopted by her mother's parents, her grandparents.
She had a really brutal upbringing with them. So she was regularly beaten by her grandfather. There were allegations of incest within the family.
Her grandfather had a home-built sauna in his house. And if he wanted to punish her for doing something he didn't like, he'd lock her in the sauna and crank up the heat and just let her stay in there.
Eileen's abusive childhood sent her on a downward spiral and fueled her hatred of men.
This was somebody who was constantly in fear. Juanos's grandfather allegedly repeatedly said to her that she was worthless, that she should never have been born, that she was a mistake. So she's learning that she can't trust anyone, that she can't depend upon anybody. And this is very, very dangerous.
Eileen learned early to use any means available to survive.
Before she got to her teen years, she was known as a cigarette bandit. She would trade sexual favors for packs of cigarettes.
It's said that from around age 11, she's using her body as something to trade, as a tool. And this kind of disconnection from her emotions is something that is going to have a significant impact on the rest of her life.
Cigarettes and sex. Her behavior left her pregnant, aged 14.
Now, on the orders of her grandfather, that baby is adopted. It's taken away from her. And this is just reinforcing those ideas that she already has, that those who are supposed to love me hurt me, that I am worthless, that I'm not deserving of love.
Shortly after she was forced to give up her child, Eileen was hit by another tragedy.
Her grandmother dies of liver failure, having been quite a heavy drinker for many years. Her grandfather actually blames her for her grandmother's death.
Her grandfather was furious and threw Juanos out of the house.
Aged just 15, Juanos was left homeless. Alone, her only option was to live in the woods at the end of their street.
She lives a very feral existence, sleeping in an old car, and she's still a child at this point. And this is incredibly damaging. There is absolutely nobody there for her. She is literally just taking each day as it comes. She's making sure that she has enough to eat. She is basically using her body as she's used it before. She's learning that life is full of rejection, it's full of pain, it's full of fear, and that she really needs to hurt others before they get the chance to hurt her.
One person she was still close to was her brother, Keith. Just 11 months older than Eileen, the rumor was that their relationship was an unnatural one.
No. There were allegations of incest. School friends of Keith said that they'd witnessed these things going on. So she felt a connection, but it was a very pathological and a very toxic one.
Unable to cope living outside during the cold winter months in Michigan, age 16, Eileen hitchhiked over 1,000 miles west to the warmer climes of Colorado. 2 years later, she was arrested for her first offense, driving under the influence and disorderly conduct, which included the dangerous discharge of a .22 caliber weapon. Eventually, in 1976, age 20, she hitchhiked 2,000 miles southeast to sunny Florida.
Damn, it is no accident that very shortly after she gets to Florida, she falls in love with, or at least decides to marry, a 69-year-old man called Louis Gratz Fell. He was president of the yacht club, but it was a doomed marriage.
She's been incredibly violent towards him. Eileen was actually beating him up. She was hitting him with his own walking cane.
Lewis put a restraining order on Juanos and filed for annulment just weeks after they were married. While the proceedings were going through, Eileen received some devastating family news.
In 1976, her brother Keith dies of throat cancer, and she's absolutely beside herself. And even though their relationship was an incredibly abnormal and dysfunctional one, she felt that she had an ally in him. But now she was completely on her own.
Eileen received $10,000 when her brother died.
She spends it almost within weeks. Guns, cars, motel rooms. And then she decides she has to sustain this lifestyle and turns to armed robbery to do it.
In 1981, she was arrested for stealing $35 and two packets of cigarettes from a convenience store. Juanos spent over a year in jail, but that didn't deter her. Over the next decade, her criminal activity escalated.
She really did demonstrate versatility. She was being arrested for driving under the influence, for assault and battery, for robbery.
One man claimed when she was a prostitute again that she whipped a gun out and put it to his head and demanded $200. She was, to put it politely, out of control.
In 1986, Warnos met a woman who changed her life.
When she met Tyree, what Aileen thought, this is my soulmate. This is the person I want to spend the rest of my life with, and I will do anything for this girl.
The owner of the Last Resort Bar in Daytona Beach, Al Bulling, remembers Warnos well, who was a regular customer.
She used to come in here. She'd shoot pool here with her girlfriend, Ty. She was a little mouthy with Aileen. If she needed a beer, she'd sit on a pool table and kind of demand her, get her another beer or whatever.
Having blown her inheritance, Warnos took it upon herself to raise the money the two needed to live.
Aileen would go out and prostitute to make money so that she could buy things for Tyrea. She would want to take care of her and make sure she was happy and never want to leave her. And I think that was what it boiled down to.
Daytona Beach, Florida, November the 30th, 1989. 33-year-old Aileen Warnos was now living with lover Tyrea Moore and was indulging in a host of petty crimes to maintain their extravagant lifestyle. The frequency of the crimes and the force Warnos used to enact them was increasing. It all came to a head the night she was picked up by 51-year-old Richard Mallory.
Richard Mallory owned an electrical repair shop, and he'd been divorced for many years, and he didn't make any secret of the fact that he did enjoy engaging in the services of sex workers.
He picked her up hitchhiking, they were drinking, they were hanging out, as it were, and one thing led to another, some type of violent encounter where she ended up killing him. She shot him four times.
One thing led to another.
With a 9-shot revolver.
Yeah.
Like it's like a nonchalant. She took a couple of pieces of property below. Yeah. One thing led to another, and she killed him.
And she pawned them. She made some money off of the deal.
When Richard Mallory's body was found 2 weeks after he was killed, there was no evidence to clarify what sparked her rage.
His body was found. It was very decomposed. Basically, all we have to work with is what we have found at the crime scene. The physical evidence and the trace evidence, etc. We do know that he was shot multiple times and his victim was found in a secluded area right outside the city of Daytona.
What triggered Warnos to kill for the first time remains a mystery. But what is certain is that the murder of Richard Mallory was the beginning of a dark and deadly chapter.
For her entire life, Warnos has been victimized by men. She's been abused by them. But now she's turned the tables. She's the one that's in control, and she's very much enjoying it because she's learned from a very early age that violence equals power. And she really is on quite a high at this point.
Taking one life once wasn't enough. 6 months later, Warnos struck again.
There's usually what they call a brief cooling off period. And this absolutely applied here. Large part of it was due to her paranoia and her fear of getting caught. And when she came back from that brief cooling off period, now she was the predator. She was looking for who she was going to kill next.
She's somebody who's being proactive. She's seeking out victims. She's getting access to them. She has an opportunity to harm them, and she takes that opportunity.
These men, they were all white males. They were all traveling the roads alone. They were middle-aged, 40 to 65.
On May the 19th, 1990, she was picked up on the I-75 highway by a 43-year-old machine operator, David Spears. When they pulled over and he began to undress, she slipped out of the passenger side door, walked around to the driver's side, aimed, and fired.
He'd been shot 6 times. One shot was not enough for Warnos. She was making a point with her killings. She was saying, this is for all the men who have abused me over the years.
This was somebody who enjoyed watching men die because for the first time in her life, she was powerful. She was the one in control. She was the one calling the shots.
David was last seen by his son leaving work at midday to meet his ex-wife. When he didn't show up, his family reported him missing.
Our patrol division had come upon a vehicle that was abandoned on I-75. It was in the southbound lane on the shoulder. It had a flat tire. And when they ran the VIN number on the vehicle, it came back to David Spears, who had been reported a missing person. We searched the area. We secured the vehicle to process it. And we found that she had taken some stuff out of the vehicle and tossed it off the side of the road into the weeds. The items included the license plate or the tag from the car.
David Spears' body was found less than 2 weeks later, dumped in Citrus County, a few miles from the I-75 highway. May the 31st, Wuornos went on the prowl again. In Pasco County, Florida, 40-year-old Charles Kaskaden, a part-time rodeo rider, picked up Wuornos about 30 minutes north of Tampa.
He was traveling back from St. Louis. He had been up there visiting his mother, and he drove back from St. Louis to the Tampa area where he was living with his fiance. And just before he got to Tampa, he encountered Aileen.
Aileen had developed a deadly routine. Once a man picked her up, his fate was sealed.
They would drive away and she'd be undressing and they'd find a remote location. She'd encourage the victim to also remove his clothes.
As Charles undressed, Wuornos slipped out of the car and came round to the driver's side door. Then, at point-blank range, she fired.
She didn't just kill. She shot Charles Kaskaden 9 times.
Once she was sure he was dead, she took his car and his possessions.
She didn't do that with Richard Mallory. She just took items she could use. Now she's starting to gather those souvenirs and those trophies, and it's becoming a passion of hers to do this stuff.
She then dumped Charles's body a few miles from the highway in Pasco County.
She left these victims basically in the middle of nowhere. And to do that to another human being, there's zero compassion. She's pure evil.
Just a week after her last killing, the deadly predator was on the hunt again. On June the 7th, Wuornos chose to work her favorite highway, the I-75 in central Florida. After 3 murders, she'd honed her technique.
Wuornos's victims were all men who drove expensive cars, so they were the symbol of success.
That night, Christian missionary Peter Sims, age 65, left his home in Jupiter, Florida, and was driving north on the I-75.
Peter Sims was on a road trip, and he never made it to his destination.
His intent was to drive up to New Jersey, and from there he had planned on going over to Arkansas. He had a number of Bibles in the car with him. He was going to pass them out along the way.
Instead, for some unknown reason, Peter Sims picked up Aileen Wuornos.
He could not have thought of as a more upright character. He also took part in an outreach Christian ministry. But I think that infuriated Wuornos because she thought, you hypocrite, I am going to kill you. And she duly did.
The following month, the car was found in the Ocala National Forest, 50 miles west of Daytona Beach. The evidence discovered would point to Wuornos as the terrifying serial killer targeting middle-aged men across the Sunshine State. Daytona Beach, Florida, July 1990. Aileen Wuornos was living in a local motel with her girlfriend, Tyria Moore. In under 7 months, the serial killer had callously shot, murdered, and robbed 4 men. In what was by now a sadistic pattern, when each of the middle-aged men pulled over and picked her up, the 34-year-old sex worker attacked.
She was just utterly remorseless. She didn't just shoot them once, she'd shoot them 3 times, 4 times, 5 times.
They had all been shot with a small caliber weapon, namely a .22. And another trait that these victims shared was that they had all been robbed of their personal effects. Their pants pockets pulled inside out, their personal ID was missing, and their vehicles was missing as well.
On July the 4th, 1990, the car belonging to 65-year-old Peter Sims was found abandoned in the Ocala National Forest in Orange Springs, an hour's drive from Daytona Beach.
Now, this is interesting because his body has never been discovered. The only way we know that he's dead is that his car was taken by Moore and Wuornos and driven around.
Aileen and Tyria had decided that they wanted to go see the fireworks in Daytona Beach. As they were driving, they noticed a sign that indicated there was an Indian reservation up in the Ocala Forest. They turned around and Tyria was going just a little bit too fast. She went off the road, the car turned on its passenger side and slid. The engine had stalled out, the carburetor had flooded, they couldn't get it started.
The witness reported the suspicious encounter to Marion County Police Department in Florida, who went to investigate.
Now, the one thing that was important to note here was that was the first time somebody actually saw these girls.
We had received a telephone call through our 911 center that a vehicle had crashed in the community of Orange Springs, Florida. And walking away from that vehicle were two women.
When they got to the scene, the investigators searched the car and made note of its distinct condition.
The license plate had been removed. The driver's side seat was in the forwardmost position, and we would find that certain things were missing from his vehicle. In this case, it was his receipt book and cash. So at this point, we have another missing person. We have no idea what happened to him.
Using the VIN number on the vehicle, the car was soon identified as belonging to missing person, Peter Sims.
We searched the area extensively. I don't know if it was for days or weeks, but it was a long time that we spent up there looking for Peter Sims' body, looking for any type of evidence.
The police found a series of pawn shop tickets in the car. When they tracked down the store, they made a major breakthrough in the case.
One pawn ticket we found was for a box of tools, and that's what was one of the things that was stolen from David Spears. The other pawn ticket we found was for a 35-millimeter camera and a radar detector. That's what was stolen from Richard Mallory.
They submitted the car to forensic examination and made an important discovery on the driver's side door handle.
Wuornos leaves a palm print in Sims's car, which will eventually become extremely significant.
Wuornos would pawn many of the items that she stole from her victims in order to get some fast money. And her fingerprints would still be on these items. Now, because Aileen had such a significant criminal record, her fingerprints were on file, and it was only going to be a matter of time before they were matched up and she was connected to these murders.
But before the police could piece the puzzle together, Wuornos struck again.
It became very frustrating. And I can remember even at times thinking, are we going to be able to solve this? Are we going to be able to come up with something? And every time we got another body, it mounted. It got worse.
On July the 30th, 1990, Wuornos selected her fifth victim, a 50-year-old salesman called Troy Burris.
Troy Burris, he had gone out to do a delivery run. And when he got to Daytona, he headed north up into Ormond Beach, made a few stops up there, turned around. When he was returning to the plant, he disappeared.
On the way back to Daytona, he picked up Aileen. Like previous victims, Troy pulled up at a secluded spot. Minutes later, Wuornos shot him twice at point-blank range. Fifty-year-old Troy's body was found 5 days later.
One of our deputies came upon his truck and it had been abandoned at the intersection of State Route 40 and 19, very isolated area.
A month later, she took her sixth life. On September the 12th, 1990, 56-year-old retired police chief Charles Dick Humphreys was coming off the I-75 when he picked up Aileen Wuornos. They drove to a deserted location a few miles off the highway in southwestern Marion County and pulled over. David Taylor was the homicide detective called to the scene.
The evidence is consistent with Mr. Humphreys getting out of the vehicle from the driver's side. We're looking at Aileen Warnos getting out from the passenger side. And it was at that point that shots rang out. So Mr. Humphreys is shot several times. He staggers over to this location, and that's where Mr. Humphreys collapses. But what was so important to us was the fact that he was shot one time at a close non-contact range, meaning that the gun was held only just a few inches away from his chest when that round was fired.
Warnos shot Charles Humphreys multiple times.
She's using much more violence than she needs to get the job done. It shows to me that she's enjoying this overkill. It's not enough to kill him. She has to destroy this individual. And this is somebody whose behavior is escalating.
By the autumn of that year, investigators were still unable to identify the killer and stop the murders.
By the time Mr. Humphreys was killed, we had thought about there being a connection. So we had contacted every agency in Central Florida, whether it was on a local, state, or federal level, because we didn't know anything. We were almost in the dark on this, and it was very frustrating.
Officers revisited the evidence from the previous six murder cases, searching for clues.
And it wasn't more than just a couple weeks later when Sergeant Brian Jarvis was actually going through other cases in Florida that had very similar MOs, such as an older white male shot multiple times, vehicle missing, and shot with a small caliber weapon. And it was Brian that began to connect a couple dots.
By winter of 1990, a task force was formed made up of detectives from several of Florida's counties.
We actually all met at the Marion County Sheriff's Office. That's when this picture began to evolve. Nah, there's a possibility these cases could be related.
While the police continued their investigation, Warnos was free to kill again.
The most important thing on our minds at that point is we gotta stop the killing. We have to do something to stop the killing. And then we started with the task force, and we had another body. It was devastating.
She kills Walter Gino Antonio, a man of 62, who was found in a logging road. He'd been shot four times in the back and the head, and his car had been stolen.
Antonio's abandoned car was found so 5 days later, just south of Daytona Beach in Brevard County.
Walter Gino Antonio was a reserve deputy sheriff with the Brevard County Sheriff's Office. And some of the things that were taken from him, personal effects, were like a set of handcuffs and a flashlight.
But the task force, another murder, was a mighty blow.
It's like, why couldn't we do more? You know, how could we let this happen? It's kind of a personal blame. And what can we do?
The task force refocused on the case of missing man Peter Sims, hoping to find clues that would lead them to the killer.
We were perplexed with that case because we had not located his body, but he was a middle-aged white male. The biggest piece of evidence in that case was we had eyewitnesses that seen these two females leaving the scene of that crash.
After interviewing the witnesses, the police were able to draw a composite sketch of the two women, and that changed everything.
I think the eureka moment came the first time we went public. Within the first hour of releasing these composites, we had a call that came in. It was item number five, our fifth lead, that named Tyria and Aileen. And in very short sequence, we had three other leads come in that also named the same girls. So now we knew there was something to that.
Those leads eventually took us to some biker bars. Now we have undercover investigators that are now going from bar to bar looking for people that look familiar with the people in the composite sketches.
One of the undercover officers sent to find the suspected serial killer was Mike Joyner.
I was the lieutenant over a special investigation unit, SIU unit. They called me in to a meeting and said that they had found out that she was staying in Daytona or close to Daytona and wanted me to go over there and see if I could find her in some of those biker bars over there and maybe, you know, get close to her.
Daytona Beach, Florida, January 1991. After callously shooting and murdering seven men, the net was finally closing in on a cruel serial killer, Eileen Wuornos.
She is a woman who took pleasure in not only killing, but also robbing her victims.
Wuornos is targeting adult men, and she's a sex worker. It's normally the sex workers who are vulnerable victims of their clients. So she looks very different. She kills like a man. She is right in front of them, watching them die, and really quite enjoying it.
34-year-old Wuornos did not know it yet, but she was about to meet her destiny in Daytona Beach. After a composite sketch was released to the public, dozens of leads came in, and Eileen Wuornos was identified as the prime suspect.
When we reviewed the leads, it showed us that they had ties to the locations that we were looking at. It indicated that they'd gone inland, which would have been Marion County, and then to the East Coast, which was Daytona Beach. So a number of the undercover officers from all over the state that we were working with went over to Daytona Beach in an attempt to locate her.
Within a couple of days, she was found by undercover police officer Mike Joyner.
I walked in a bar down there, and I saw she was shooting pool, and I recognized her, and she had a bad scar on her forehead. Did my heart go to racing and beating? No. An undercover officer, worst enemy head can be himself if he don't control his emotions. So I just ordered another beer and kept on working. But I knew I had her. And I knew I wasn't gonna let it out of my sight.
Mike spent 3 days following Wuornos around the biker bars in the area. In his bid to get close to her, he even slept at her favorite hangout, The Last Resort.
And they had school buses, seats, all on the back porch. And that's where I slept, was on the school bus. And when they opened the bar up at 7 o'clock, you went back inside and went drinking again and shooting pool. I mean, that's all you're doing. You shot pool and drank beer. And she had no money and I had all the money, so who was she gonna stay the closest to? Which got to know her from then on. I had her. And I started buying her beer and playing pool, and you kind of hung together.
With the task force secretly stationed outside, on January the 9th, 1991, Mike Joyner made his move.
We were in the bar, we were dancing, and I had a lot of money, and that's what she was interested in. And she wanted to know if I wanted to go out and one night and party. And I told her, I said, yeah, I'd love to go out, but I said, you stink. You ain't had a bath. And I don't know when. And I said, I stink. And I said, I ain't doing that. I'll go get a motel room and we'll clean up, but I ain't going out with no stinking ass woman.
Mike told Wuornos to wait for him at the bar while he went to get his room key. Instead, he met with a task force outside.
And I meet with my outside people and tell them, you know, we make a plan because we knew what she had in mind. The exact words I told them was, piss on the fire and call in the dogs. This hunt's over with. This is her. And I'm not going off with her because I'm not going to be the next victim.
Mike returned to the bar with a motel key and showed it to Wuornos. He then waited for her to make the next move.
Did I get worried about it? No, she wasn't gonna kill me in the bar. I wasn't, you know, I really wasn't worried about it, not at that point. I just went and got another beer and said, just whenever you get ready, I'm ready to go. Let's go.
A little while later, one of the undercover cop
walked out to
the bar. The owner of the last resort, Al Bulling, was an eyewitness to what happened next.
They were just sitting at the bar drinking, you know. They didn't want to arrest her in the bar or anything because they didn't know what she had or didn't want nobody else getting hurt. So they waited for her to walk out the door. As soon as they hit the door, that's when they arrested her.
Wuornos was bundled into a car and taken away. The task force had successfully executed the arrest safely.
I wasn't worried about my safety because I had the best backup in the world.
It was a relief. I think that's the best way to describe it, as a relief.
The next day, investigators managed to track down Wuornos' partner, Tyria Moore, in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Oh, wow.
And they said
she
to her, let's make a deal.
If
you can
attractive.
Provide evidence, good. If you can help
whole,
us convict Eileen Wuornos, then we will give you immunity from prosecution. So
she's
I think this was a very, very tempting offer.
Tyria agreed to call Eileen and let the police record their conversations.
Lee, they're coming after me. I know they are.
No, they're not. What?
Okay. Yes. Why in the hell did you do this? Why did you do this?
Listen, Ty.
So much regret after you do it, right? Or after you get caught.
Yes. I love you. If I have to confess, I will. Okay. Yes. Why in the hell did you do this? Why did you do this? Listen, Ty. So much regret after you do it, right? Or after you get caught. Yes. I love you. If I have to confess, I will. Okay. No.
The same month she was arrested, Eileen Wuornos fully confessed to the seven murders.
Well, I came here to confess. I want to be straight up with one thing right there and now.
Sure.
The reason I'm confessing is there's not another girl. There is one.
Okay, so then what you're telling us is you're voluntarily coming forward to talk to us now.
Yeah, to let you know that I'm the one that did the killing.
Despite the seriousness of her crimes, Wuornos refused an attorney.
Well, what's an attorney going to do? I know what I did, I'm confessing what I did, so
But in what was the cornerstone of her defense, she claimed that in each case, the men had tried to rape her.
See, most of the times I was drunk as hell, and I was a professional hooker. And these guys would take my s**t if they started to get drunk with me or whatever. I just, like, opened up and fired up. I just tried to make my money and go.
Wuornos is trying to look out for herself. She's still trying to perform this role as the victim because I think she's more than familiar with the fact that many sex workers are regularly raped and assaulted by their clients. And I think she's trying to garner a bit of sympathy for herself in doing this.
I don't know what to do. I know that I don't want my girlfriend involved because this is why I'm doing this. They've been talking to her parents.
Her trial for first-degree murder started a year later on January the 13th, 1992, at the Volusia County Courthouse near Daytona.
It was an extraordinary defense. After all, she could simply have reported them to the police. But she didn't do that. She took the law into her own hands and indeed executed them herself.
Wuornos is a simmering pot of resentment, and it's not enough that she's killed her victims, but she wants to make them suffer after they've died. She wants to tarnish their reputations. So she says that her victims picked her up, they targeted her, they were the predators, not her.
In an unusual twist, Wuornos was only tried for her first murder, that of 51-year-old Richard Mallory. Florida State Attorney John Tanner was the lead prosecutor.
In Florida, if you have a series of crimes that are related in certain factors, then you may be able to bring in evidence of those other crimes. And in this case, it was murder.
Called the Williams Rule, John Tanner was able to draw a link between the seven murders.
Each of these killings looked almost identical, showing, I think, basically that this appeared to be the print of the same killer. And it certainly challenged the theory that she was simply defending herself against rape. When you're saying that everyone that picked me up tried to rape me, and credibility is becomes a real issue.
On January the 27th, 1992, Eileen Warnos was found guilty of the murder of Richard Mallory and sentenced to death. Then she pulled a major surprise.
One of the odd twists of this whole thing, after being sentenced for Richard Mallory's death, she elected to plead guilty for five other counts of first-degree murder, and she accepted the death penalty without going to trial. She really just wanted to get it over with. She didn't want to go to trial again. She didn't want to face Tyria.
By November 1992, Warnos had been given a total of six death sentences. She was never charged with the murder of Peter Sims, as his body was never found. After 10 years of appeals and litigation, she finally met her fate.
Very close to the end of her life, she said, "I have hate crawling through my system. I'm competent, sane, and trying to tell the truth. I'm one who seriously hates human life, and I would kill again."
Eileen Warnos was executed by lethal injection on October the 9th, 2002.
Her reactions were a typical Eileen. She was verbal. She was discussing something about the mothership's ready to blast off, that she would be back again one day, and here we go.
I've told a lot of people that when we stop talking about Bonnie and Clyde, that'll probably be the same day we quit talking about Aileen Warnos.
Some people believe that she was an abuse victim, that she was very childlike, vulnerable. Other people feel that she was a sadistic killer. She enjoyed ending men's lives. In reality, it was probably a bit of both, and that's why we continue to be fascinated by her.
In just 1 year, she callously killed seven men in cold blood and then robbed them. She had a record unmatched by any other female killer. The violent nature of her multiple murders makes Eileen Warnos one of the world's most evil killers.
Wow.
Wow is right.
I told you, though, she said, "I will be back one day." Like, that
and
is funny.
I forgot to mention this before I started this documentary. So she was apprehended in January of 1991. Want to hear something really crazy?
What's that?
3 months later, 4 months, 2 months later, I was in Daytona Beach with my college.
That's so wild.
Spring break.
That's wild because my dad lived in Daytona Beach during that time. So that was that's wild you said that. So that's a crazy connection, man. That's so creepy, though. Imagine you ran into Warnos. Like, oh, man.
Yeah, I was there in 1991, March of 1991. And when I saw it, when I looked at some of the information yesterday, I saw that I went, holy crap. Yeah. 2 months later, I was there. So,
and who would have thought, like, who would have thought that many years down the road, like now, we start a podcast and we look at this and then you find that connection. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
those coincidences,
weird, eh?
I love it. I love it.
Yeah. I just aged myself, by the way, too. So
did you? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. 1991, I was in college.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, dude. And that 1991 to 2024 feels like it was 1990 to 1952. You know what I'm saying? Like, it just seems like that big of a gap now. It's like
30 years ago. Over 30 years ago.
I know.
Yeah, it's crazy. But no, that was a good one. I've been wanting to do this one. I thought about this one in season one because I saw it and I was going, should I wait till season two? So there you go. Chris graduated high school in 1991.
You guys are old bastards.
Thank you.
Had to get him.
It's all right, Chris. It's all right, buddy. You know, the good thing is about men, and I'm going to say this about men, is as we get older, we get better looking. Unfortunately, with some women.
Yeah. Oh, geez.
Yeah. But no, I'm just kidding. But no, that's it's a really good one. And again, she's right up there to being one of the worst of the worst. And she didn't care. She didn't care at all. And she didn't care about human life. But I will say, it doesn't surprise me with this woman because of what she went through most of her life. Men did a lot of bad things to her. And I think it's probably one of the worst is her grandfather, somebody that you're supposed to look up to, basically blamed you for your grandmother's death and kicked you out on the streets when you're 15 years old. You just can't come back from that stuff, you know? And her having a sexual relationship with her brother, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to say, really I don't agree with, because I know with some of these documentaries, they say, was this person born to kill? I don't think anybody's born to kill. I think they're molded. I think
their environment. Yeah.
They're molded into doing these crimes. And unfortunately, this woman is right up there. So many men did her wrong. And it's really an unfortunate thing. You know, I know she did a lot of petty... I know she did a lot of petty crimes and stuff like that, but really, who hasn't? Who hasn't gone in a variety store and taken something they're not supposed to? But that's not going to make you into a killer.
No.
You know, but what she went through, in her life when it came to men was just unfortunate. And, you know, what I was going to say, if her grandfather didn't kick her out, didn't blame her for her grandmother's death, could she have turned out differently?
No, you're absolutely right. And you know what? This is a consistent pattern that we've been noticing with certain serial killers, like at least a lot of them. I wouldn't say all of them. I would say, you know, because we had one that was more of like a trickster, that one guy that we just did, Patrick McKay. He was more of a trickster growing up. I mean, he did have some like bad stuff, but not like Eileen, she had, you know, her grandfather, all the trouble, you know, that you just spoke about with her grandfather. I mean, that's very devastating, especially to a young girl, probably at 15, you know what I mean? Yeah. That's got to be so devastating. So,
yeah. And I would also have to say Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka.
Yeah, them too. Yeah.
They didn't really have bad family lives at all.
No.
But I said especially Carla. Especially Carla. She really didn't have a bad family life. And she came from I know Paul Bernardo came from a well-off family. And so, you know, there was really nothing bad in those families. But for somebody like this, the writing was on the wall of what was going to happen to this girl, this woman.
Sadly.
And unfortunately, her being put to death is, you know, it's an unfortunate thing. It really is. I don't like to see, you know, I don't think her killing all these people and then turning them around and then killing her by lethal injection is the right thing to do. I know in some cases it is, especially when there's children involved, but I don't know. I'm just never really been a big fan of the death penalty. So,
you know, I'm not either, but like we spoke about on a previous show, it's like, it all depends too. Like if it's your loved one that's getting hurt, you would feel differently, you know, like how we discussed, but in the same way, it's like, you know, looking at it from a third person point of view, you know, cause we don't know any of those victims, we're like, you know what, maybe she shouldn't have gotten a death penalty. Maybe she should have just suffered in jail for the rest of her life. That would have been bad enough. But you know what, those families probably felt like how we would feel if it was our family member. So it's a fine line of how we can try to treat it. You know, it's really hard.
Well, I've seen, you know, other stories like nothing, not like hers, but other families going through this, that a loved one was murdered and the person was you know, got a death sentence. And you hear the families going, you know what? I heard one family say, you know what? Now a lot more families are going to be affected by all of this. And a death sentence is really not the way to end it. No. But
yeah,
I don't know. I just, I guess I've just heard so many stories, and I'm sure you have as well, that people getting executed and they were wrongly accused. And, you know, so I think that's one of the reasons why I'm not a huge fan of the death penalty. But again, when it comes to children, that's that's a little bit of a different story. So, but anyhow, other than that, that is our show for this week. We do not get to thank these people enough that are listening to our podcast through Spotify, iHeart, and all those different places where people steal steal podcasts from. So, but yeah, and I want to thank everybody that came in the room today. And as always, again, thank you. And thank you to my other host. Now, I felt bad last week. No, it wasn't you. I think it was Lex I said it to. I think it was Lex who said it. I said, my co-host. He's not my co-host. He's my, he's the other host, just like you are. You're my other half.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. Well, I want to give a shout out real quick to Spotify, iHeartRadio, all the people that watch on Apple. I mean, listen on Apple Podcasts, all that stuff. Thank you guys so much for listening in every single week. For everyone who follows us, thank you so much. For everyone who doesn't follow us, please hit the follow button. It helps us a lot through the platforms. We get it all on our RSS page. We get all the locations so we know where all of you guys are watching from. We appreciate everyone overseas as much as everyone.
Belgium. Belgium is listening.
Right?
What's,
Belgium.
What's
that's
going
awesome.
On?
I know. I love it. I love it. Absolutely love it. So thank you guys so much. We can't thank you all enough, and all of our listeners on all these platforms, from Facebook to everything, LinkedIn, all that. Thank you guys so much. But until next week, I just want to say, Aileen, case is closed.
Didn't hear it.
Oh, man. You know what? I got to work on that. It was going to be a gunshot.